There is a teaching of the Buddha, which is maybe humorous, if you like humor of this kind. And this is, Buddha said that if you take a hen and let the hen sit on its eggs under normal circumstances, eventually the eggs will hatch, even if the hen does not want them to hatch. The natural process of, once there's eggs and embryos inside, that the natural process is that they will eventually grow and develop and break out and have the shell. So that was used as an analogy, and the Buddha said that if a person puts all the right conditions into place, if you sit on your eggs well, then you will become awakened, even if you don't want to. So that's why we're sitting so much. But this, in this kind of, you know, metaphor, this, you know, sitting on our eggs, sitting, nurturing something, incubating something, warming it up, letting something mature and grow and develop, is a very different idea of spiritual progress than that of an engineer or I'm going to do it. I'm responsible. I'm capable, and I'm going to, you know, take my capable mind or heart. I'm going to apply this, and I'm going to nail it faster than anyone. After all, there are important things to do in life, and we want to get on with it. And this enlightenment thing is just getting in the way because it takes so long. So there can be very kind of self-centered, self-involved, self-determined, kind of like, I'm the one who's going to do it. Kind of exaggerating language, but kind of make the point. But the over and over again in the teachings of the Buddha, he doesn't use that kind of language for the growth, maturity, and the practice. He talks about it from the point of view of providing supporting conditions for natural growth to occur. And he also uses the analogy of a farmer growing plants. The farmer doesn't cause the plants to grow, but rather creates the conditions that the plants can mature. And so you protect them, you water them, you feed them, but, you know, the farmer's not then they're pulling on the plants, you know, grow faster, you know. So they're just allowing them, you know, providing the conditions for it. And the third analogy the Buddha used for kind of to grow, you know, the way it's kind of the path or the unfolding can happen in practice, is that of water flowing downhill. Rainwater comes on the hillside, as he described, and if there's enough rain, the drops start flowing down, the drops find other drops, and they grow and become bigger, and they flow down and become creeks, and little rivulets, and they flow into ponds, and when the ponds get full, they spill over and become rivers that flow down further and into lakes, and the lakes get full, they flow further and become bigger rivers, and eventually flow out to the ocean. And unless you put a dam up or put boulders in the way of some of these small little creeks, the water will just keep flowing. That's the nature of gravity, nature of water. They'll flow downhill. And so here also the idea is that it's not our doing so much as we do the right, create the right conditions at some point, not at the get-go, but at some point the conditions are right, where the unfolding, the maturing, the incubating happens kind of on its own, like water flowing downriver, downhill. So the premise of this kind of idea is that what we contribute are the conditions. And we create the conditions that allow something to happen. And the teachings about conditionality is very important in Buddhism. And it kind of implies that this impermanent world that we live in is not random or chaotic, but rather it does unfold according to certain, unfold under certain conditions. And so when the conditions are one way, they'll flow one way. The conditions change, and the flow of how things unfold is going to be different. And we can have an effect on the conditions. We can contribute, or we can have an effect on the impermanent changing of life. Impermanence doesn't mean that everything is just, you sit back and just let it all happen to you, and just be kind of almost a victim of impermanence. But rather that we can contribute new conditions. We can change the conditions. And the role of a practitioner is to contribute the conditions that allow for something to happen, something to mature and to grow and develop and to hatch, hopefully. So there is a role, there is a responsibility for the practitioner, but it's a limited role. It's a role of contributing conditions, not the role of making things happen. That's a little, kind of the distinction we're making here. So when people talk about the Dharma, and that's the topic for today, refuge in the Dharma. As I said the other night, the Dharma, refuge in the Dharma refers to three things. It refers to the teachings, the teachings of liberation that point to liberation, the practices that point to freedom, and the experience of realization itself. And these all belong to the world of the Dharma that can be a refuge support for us as we go along. And part of this idea of it being a refuge is that they are conditions that can support us. The teachings are more like intellectual conditions. They don't maybe offer us a lot, but ideas and guidance and inspiration. The practices are what offers the most support. Buddhism is a practice-centered religion. It's not so much about belief as it is about practices that we do, and those practices are the practices that we can have confidence and we can trust, we can take refuge in, that those practices create the conditions that support us. Without practicing, we don't have the support of the practice. With the practice, the idea is that we're creating conditions for the support. And this is a little bit different than how some people focus on the purpose of practice. Some people focus on it as if practice is about having certain experiences. And I'm supposed to get these experiences, which creates has some truth to it, but that creates a very different kind of attitude or approach to practice when I'm looking for an experience, because experiences are all dependent upon conditions being a certain way. So if you think an experience is the point, then you're kind of looking in the wrong place for what your role is. And then maybe you're looking for the wrong place for what you're trying to build and develop. But rather, we create the conditions, we contribute the conditions that allow certain things to occur. And the main emphasis in, as far as I could tell, in this Buddhist tradition, is that the emphasis is not really on having an experience. The idea of focusing so much on an experience is probably overrated, kind of leads people a little astray. But rather, in our tradition, it's to create conditions to allow for insight to occur. And when the insight occurs, those are the condition, not the guarantee, but those are the condition for allow for something to, for us to drop some burden, for us to kind of put to rest some ideation, some inner kind of unconscious commitment we have to being attached to things, or being closed, or resisting. So we open up, we let go, we become liberated, become free. So the idea of conditionality. And so here, coming to the retreat center, you come here to contribute or to create to be in a certain particular condition. This is a very different condition to live in than living in Grand Central Station, or living at Macy's, or, you know, there's all kinds of things, places you can live, you can hang out a lot, and those have a different effect on us. So being in a peaceful, quiet, relatively safe place, without TV and without computer, with people who are kind and supportive, more than many other places, where there's not a lot of requirement of complicated work to be done, and I hope by now that you have in fact mastered your Sangha service, and now you don't have any real questions about how to do it anymore. It's just pretty straightforward. And so it's a kind of simplicity here, there's some people find it very nurturing to be in a schedule that lets them even they don't have to think about, well, what should I do next, and should I go sit, or should I walk, or just follow the schedule. And so it's kind of, it's a lot of things get put down, a lot of kind of concerns and preoccupations can be put to rest. And it isn't so much that we have to almost put them to rest, they kind of recede over time. I think that just simply being in a place like this for a week without talking and just walking around and, I don't know, sitting having tea, it's probably like, you know, a fairly high percentage of what the benefit is, you know, or the change, because just that, such a different condition that lets something else happen. We get to sleep, we get fed well, and all these things. So we're coming here, and certain conditions are here that are here intentionally that we think are supportive for the kind of deeper work that we're trying to do. And then added to those are other conditions. We follow the ethical guidelines when we're here. As, you know, and the goodness that comes from that creates conditions that supports certain kind of, for some people, a relaxation, an ease, a letting go, not so defended. And I don't underestimate how significant it is for some people to come into a place where it's safe. There are many people in our society who do not have safety. They have never had safety in their life. They don't even know what it is. And to come to a place where they kind of get a sense, oh, this is safe, you know, and something can release, relax perhaps, and that allows, that's a condition for something else to happen, to look at themselves in a new way, or to deal with something they've never dealt with. And then we add some of the wisdom teachings. So the idea with some of the wisdom teaching has a lot to do with being kind to yourself, supportive of yourself, and kind of getting out of your own way by maybe not being so judgmental or so critical, or not trying to engineer the perfect meditation experience, but just kind of learning to be somewhat accepting of what happens at the moment. Because the idea of getting out of your way and not trying to engineer it, and certain kind of healthy acceptance of this moment as it's given to you, that creates a very different condition or something to unravel, unfold, relax, resolve itself, than, you know, being the one who's in there hammering away and doing manual labor or something. So I think you get the idea that we're putting together conditions. So when we're trying to be mindful, trying to be aware, trying to have awareness grow, is we're trying to allow the conditions that this natural capacity for awareness can grow and develop and strengthen. And the right combination is of making effort to be aware versus allowing awareness, that kind of equation, that kind of balance varies from day to day, hour to hour a little bit. Sometimes it's really, we offer our effort to help for, as a condition that supports awareness. Sometimes we back off, and allowing is the condition that lets it kind of grow. And so the emphasis over and over again is the conditions as opposed to the doing. We're putting something in place, we're sitting on our eggs, we're allowing something to happen. So then we get to the heart of the Dharma for, I think, Vipassana practitioners. Vipassana is insight. So there are three insights, which are the heart of the kind of Dharma. And that is impermanence, dukkha, sometimes translated as suffering, sometimes as unsatisfactoriness, and not self. And those three are emphasized a lot. When I was in Thailand and Burma practicing, I couldn't believe how much these teachers talked about impermanence, suffering, and not self. Over and over and over again, like the same Dharma talk. Every teacher seemed to have the same talk. And like, what's going on here? And then because it was so emphasized, I felt like, well, I better understand it. So I had to grapple a little bit with, struggle a little bit with these teachings, because, you know, even though they offered them with confidence, it didn't necessarily mean that I had to accept them as being given. So I spent a fair amount of time reflecting and trying to think what they actually mean, and until it started to make some sense. But one of the, but I think that sometimes overemphasizing these three, the teachings are overemphasizing impermanence and not self, and suffering, does some people a disservice. It's not a condition. Those teachings are not a condition, which are universally inspiring or helpful. So some people live lives where impermanence is way too painful. Things are changing all the time for them. They never had any stability in their life. They moved growing up every year, every 6 months, they were always moving. And they never knew who was taking care of them, what adult was taking care of them. Their, you know, parents disappeared when they were quite young, grandparents died when they were taking care of them and growing up. You know, they were shuttled around between aunts. These are stories that I hear frequently from people about, you know, challenges they have. You know, lives of poverty often, very unstable and insecure. And this instability and insecurity what people live with. And then they come, you know, to hear a Buddhist teacher like myself saying, oh, it's all impermanent. That's the good news. you know, you better accept it. It's not very helpful for them. And then I come and say, you know, so it's all suffering. You know, some people, that's what their life has been, unmitigated suffering. I mean, they're horrendous, the kind of lives that some people live, constant challenge. And then to come here, it's all suffering. It's like, well, there's no hope then. My God, you know. Then I might as well just give up. Or to hear that there is, you know, there's no self, sometimes we say. Some people have had a terrible conditioning around self and have somehow been dismissed or ignored or not seen or been told told they don't count or been told they're not wanted by their parent. You know, you're never really wanted. And so they kind of like recede and disappear, and somehow like they feel like they don't count or they shouldn't count or something. And so to be told there's no self, I mean, that can either be depressing, or they can feel like, oh, this is my religion. Finally I belong, because I don't, you know, because somehow validates the very lack of self that they've kind of, the conditions have kind of brought about for them. So I think it's, you know, so the insights are very important. And so I don't want to diminish their tremendous value and how important they are for this practice. But this is the kind of the thing. The practice is not about seeing the three characteristics. It's not a, the practice is not, we don't practice seeing impermanence. Like, you know, now look and see impermanence exactly. You know. We don't practice to suffer. We don't practice to for not self exactly. We, you know, that's not the practice. The practice is to create the conditions that allow us to have those insights. And so the practice is to create stability, the kind of stability that makes it possible to see impermanence in a useful way. to create the kind of happiness and well-being that allows us to see suffering in a way that doesn't crush us, but that's actually supportive and helpful. The condition, we create the conditions for confidence, strong inner confidence and strength, that creates the conditions so that we can see the teaching, the insight into not-self. These two go hand in hand. We create the conditions for the insights. We practice to create those conditions. When the time is right, then those conditions mature into allowing us to see in a way we haven't seen before. And so the idea of seeing is really as insight is a very different approach than learning a belief system around the three characteristics. You know, you should believe that everything is impermanent. You're supposed to believe that it's, you know, dukkha, suffering and satisfaction. You're supposed to have this orientation, this worldview, and understand that there's no self here. And then when you have that understanding, you can kind of negotiate the world. That's not my understanding of what insight is. Those teachings, as wisdom teachings, do have their usefulness. So it's useful to hear them and know them. But it isn't that we're supposed to kind of turn ourselves into a pretzel to kind of live them, be it. But rather pointing us, encouraging us, hopefully, towards the insights. So creating the conditions, so the Dharma practice, we take refuge in the conditions. And conditions are impermanent. Conditions are not, you know, so reliable you can always be there. But we can do our best we can, and we try to develop them so that they can be, kind of have some lasting value for us. Because a lot of things change a lot, but the dispositions we create, the inner sense of character, the inner sense of personal strength that we develop, and confidence we can develop, self-understanding we can develop, of course those things change. But they can be much more lasting. And, you know, they can last for years, maybe the rest of a lifetime, some of the things that we cultivate and develop. And so to cultivate, like a farmer grows plants, to incubate, like a hen on its eggs, the practice, I think is kind of a very, for me, when I hear these kinds of words, these kinds of ideas, I get a feeling of loving what I'm doing, like tending. It's like a farmer tends the plants, cares for. One of my favorite places I was a farmer for a while and gardener for a while, and it was a wonderful experience of love. Even just walking around and tending the plants. Sometimes I would go to the garden. And when I was at Tassajara, I was a gardener for a while, Zen monastery. And I would go get there in the morning to the garden. And I had a little problem. And that was, I didn't want to work right away. I just wanted to go around and look at everything and love all the plants. Come to light, oh, look at that. Oh, you know. And then I would get to work a little bit after a while. But this idea of tending and cultivating and developing, in my vocabulary, are all movements of kind of nurturing something, loving something, out of compassion, out of care. And in terms of doing the practice, cultivating or developing ourselves, comes hopefully from an understanding that each of us is valuable, that we're important, we're significant, we're to be cherished, we're to be cared for. It's worth tending ourselves and caring for our hearts. It's a beautiful thing to do. And so, creating stability. So there's many conditions that help create a stable mind and a stable heart. Meditation is one of them. Concentration practice, kind of, or persistence, coming back, and just coming back very simply over and over again. Just being here. Coming back to the next sitting, letting the mind wanders off and coming back, find oneself coming back, being here, hanging for a while with the breath, just being with the breath, riding the breath, surfing on the experience of breathing, so that things begin to settle around it, so that the distracted mind begins to kind of quiet down and fall away, and so we can kind of stay still and quiet for longer. Looking at our lives, how we live our lives, and making behavioral choices about our lives so that we live lives that don't lead to instability of mind, but lead to a mind being more stable and centered. And it's easy to have, you know, an agitated, complicated, busy, racing mind. You know, it can be as simple as when you're going to schedule things to do, you give yourself more than enough time to get there so that you can come in a relaxed way. But if you're always late, just catching up and racing, then, you know, the mind will get activated, and, you know. So you make a choice. I'm going to be more careful with my schedule, build into the schedule time to get to places so I can be calm. It's just one little example, but it's possible to make behavioral choices in our lives that support stability. We're still going to go up and down, and things will happen, for sure, but it tends towards more stability. We practice every day, meditate every day, tends to greater stability. Certain meditation practices, depending on the person and the circumstances of their life, are more supportive for stability than other practices. Sometimes loving-kindness practice is a very great stabilizing practice. Sometimes a simple breath practice. Sometimes open awareness practice. So it depends what, you know, what's the right thing. But the principle is, how do we go to a steadiness, a kind of a sweet stillness, a kind of maybe kind of inner quiet. So, or maybe, I like the word stable. And the stability that we're looking for would be kind of like that of a tripod that holds a telescope, so you can see clearly through the telescope. If you take a telescope and hold it in your hand to look at the moon or star, you know, you probably can't hold it still enough to see. But if you put it in a tripod, then it's be still, and then you can see clearly. So that's the purpose of the stability in the end, is to be able to see clearly what's going on. What's going on in our hearts and our minds, deep inside. And it's not so easy to see, look under the hood. I don't know if I want to, maybe I shouldn't compare you to a car, since I've already compared you to a hen. But you know, to look into the heart, to really see what's operating there, what's really the operating principles are, what's really been churning and working and maybe eating away, or the challenges that we have in there. It takes a lot of stability, and the more stability we have, the easier it is to kind of be with some of the difficult things that are within us. So we cultivate stability, we love stability, we tend to it, we're looking for that. And then we're cultivating well-being. I like the word well-being a lot, because it's kind of a broad term that's kind of just, for me, in my mind, the vocab word, it's just kind of general sense of ease or well-being. As soon as I use other words like happy, it's like too high a bar, or it's too kind of specialized. It's appropriate in some circumstances to be happy, but there are other circumstances where, you know, it's just not appropriate to go around being too happy. You know, you go to a funeral, and if you're too happy, it's like not quite, you know, whistling and skipping down the aisle, and you know, you can have a sense of a certain kind of well-being at a funeral, even though you might feel sad, even though you might feel quiet. So I like the word well-being, but it includes things like joy and happiness, delight, gladness, and one of the cultivating well-being is an important part of Buddhist practice. We're looking to cultivate that. Not because we're supposed to be happy-go-lucky people, not because we're supposed to look like we're kind of like happy all the time, but it turns out that having some kind of inner sense of well-being is a very important supportive condition that allows us to look at what's difficult, It allows us to have insight into the nature of suffering. And I still have a very kind of visceral memory of practicing in Burma and feeling such a tremendous sense of stable well-being, kind of joy and happiness that came from doing the practice I was doing there. And I was fairly still and concentrated in practicing. And then I could see operating my mind in a different way than I'd ever seen before, because the conditions were ripe for a certain kind of understanding of the mind. And I saw that just about every kind of thought that I had was stressful to have, had a certain kind of stress or agitation as part of it. And then I thought, well, I knew there was a lot of suffering in the world. That's why I was practicing, because of all the suffering I knew in the world that I wanted to somehow respond to. But when I saw that all these subtle thoughts had suffering or stress built into them, I was like blown away. I said, wow, there's much more suffering in this world than I ever realized. I had to stop in my track. I was just like stunned. But rather than being depressed by it or overwhelmed by it, it was held by the sense of well-being that I had. The juxtaposition of the well-being and encountering this kind of insight made the insight not a problem in a sense. It became a very important insight that motivated me and was an important motivator as I continued my practice. So we cultivate well-being. And one of the most common ways that many Buddhist teachers will emphasize for doing that is to practice generosity. And there's something about generosity that can support well-being, joy, and happiness. It's not automatic, but it can happen, and sometimes we have to kind of explore our inner terrain or inner attitudes we have to understand how we relate to generosity and our acts of giving that we do and support we do to others, to see how we can understand it in such a way that we start feeling kind of a lightness and a happiness and an openness, you know, delight from it. So we're nourished by it. Forget about those people you're being generous to. You know, they can do what they want with generosity, but I'm here to, you know, get nourished. I don't think you should be that selfish, but you know, I'm just making the point that the idea for generosity in Buddhism is not just to be generous because it's a duty, but to be generous as a practice also that supports us. It can bring joy. That's that very common part of the, you know, traditional teaching. And then you can remember that. Look back and, oh, look, that was so nice that I did that. I feel good that I did that. That really makes me happy. And so it becomes kind of a available joy to in our memory. Oh, yeah, look at that. So wise giving, wise generosity, ethical life. I was kind of surprised to hear that when I came to Thailand, that people were supposed to be happy that they were ethical. I thought they were weird, because I had no, that was like outside my understanding that ethics can bring joy. But then I learned that in fact it can bring a sense of well-being. And then the practices of meditation also are meant to bring some kind of well-being. And this is where we have to be very careful, even saying it, and searching for it, that we're not trying to engineer it or expect it too much or get disappointed if it doesn't happen fast enough or something like that. Because we have very important inner lives to resolve, to work through, to meet and tend and care for. But it is, the direction is to go in the direction of having some sense of inner well-being. So the heart can purr like a cat, or the inner life can, you know, the inner life becomes a welcoming place to be, because there is a sense of safety there, there's a sense of delight there, or joy, or, I'm trying to avoid using the word well-being too many times, a sense of well-being that's in there. So, what are the conditions for your well-being, for joy and delight? And some people find that there's much more joy or delight or happiness available than they avail themselves of. And if we're preoccupied by something, then we might not notice the sunset that's beautiful. If we're preoccupied about what they're going to serve at IRC for supper, we might not enjoy the cookie that's for lunch. Because, you know, we're so thinking ahead. We have the cookie, but we're, you know, thinking about something else. So those are, you know, it's possible to miss, not notice, because we're caught up and preoccupied. We want something to happen. We're concerned about something. So can we avail ourselves inappropriate, without being Pollyannish, without being kind of, are there things that can bring us support and nourish simple, ordinary experiences of joy and delight more often than we tend to avail ourselves of? Being at IRC, and there are challenges being in any community, and there's challenges being in the community here, but I hope that it doesn't take too much reflection to appreciate that this is kind of a phenomenal gathering of people to be this way and share practice like this and be willing to be silent together and do the work together to support the retreat. It's, you know, the hope, my hope is that in some modicum of way, minor way maybe, that to reflect and to feel what's going on here can be a source of some joy, some delight. The cooks come out of the kitchen to ring the bell for the food. Could that be a moment of joy and delight, like these cooks do? It's a wonderful thing. You know, they come there and they offer. And I know for me, since Andre and I are some of the cooks, right? We make breakfast. I love making their breakfasts. I love doing it. It's so quiet in there and going around doing everything, but also knowing, just thinking about, oh, look, I get to feed these people. It's like a great thing. And then standing up there, ready to ring the bell, and I get to bow to all of you and offer you. It's like pretty special. So it's a joy for me. It seems like pretty cheap joy. I just make the oatmeal. So you should try it sometime, make the oatmeal. So availing ourselves of the simple, obvious joys, is it possible? Can we nourish ourselves and support ourselves by it? Is it possible to access bigger ways? Is it possible to somehow have insight, understanding of ourselves well enough that we start dropping some of the burdens we carry that keeps us from appreciating our life, appreciating the moment? Some of the strong feelings of guilt, strong feelings of regret, strong feelings of shame, anger, hate, fear. Can we begin kind of thawing or softening? Starting to have it begin to break up so it's not such a solid mass. And in the breaking up of it, kind of beginning to appreciate the cracks through which light shines, through something we see something a different way. Because it can be a kind of a self-supporting system where as we begin to feel a little bit more well-being, it allows us to open to more well-being. And this is part of the practice. Though some people, you know, especially, hopefully all of you have been, those of you who have been here on retreat long enough, no longer feel what newcomers often feel when they come to a retreat. All these people, they're so serious. Way too serious, somber. It can look like that for sure. And you sit down at the dining room table, and like out in the regular world, it's like bad news if you sit down at a table of people and they continue to look at their food and not acknowledging your existence. It's like, wow, I guess I'm not wanted here or something. But it's, you know, it's people are sitting there communing with their oatmeal. They're like communing with their practice, doing their practice, and this is we're not here to be socially interactive. So the people aren't being, you know, too serious, I hope, or unkind or unfriendly, but it's so people can feel this way. But I hope that over time, over retreats, that something begins to develop and grow, and some plant of goodness grows in you. And then there's a condition of confidence. I don't know exactly, you know, there's probably a range of things that are the condition that supports the insight into not-self. The ability to not take things, everything so personally. That we don't have to define everything we do and say and think and feel. We don't have to define ourselves by it. We don't have to constantly relate it to an identity we have or who we think we should be or who we think we shouldn't be. We don't have to make conclusions about who I am because I'm angry. It's okay, you know, there can be anger, but I don't have to be the angry person, just anger. There can be sadness, but there's no sad person. There could be anything. There could be sadness or depression, and then there can be shame or embarrassment for having it. To not take it personally, just let it just be simple. Simple sadness, simple depression, simple anger, simple joy, simple happiness. You know, as opposed to me, myself, and mine. But to have that ability to see it without seeing a self in it, just letting it be, in some ways is very respectful for all of our what's happening. To not burden it with all this extra stuff. But to have that insight, to have that understanding, it really helps to have a lot of confidence or a lot of inner strength. Or most Buddhists don't like to use this, what I'm about to say, so, you know, don't tell people that I've used this, I've said it. Gil said. But in Western psychological terms, to develop a strong sense of self, which in Western psychology doesn't mean the abstract thing of a strong self. It means you cultivate certain qualities of self-understanding, self-monitoring, patience, honesty, efficacy, and confidence. There's a whole series of things we develop, qualities we develop, that are, you know, associated with having a strong sense of self. So part of the function of the practice is to cultivate this kind of confidence. Confidence in self, the fourth refuge in self. And rather than becoming disempowered people, the hope is that we become empowered people as we practice. That rather than someone who feels like they're not supposed to act, we become people who have the courage to act when necessary and important. That we're not dismissing ourselves in practice, we're doing the opposite. We're not getting caught up in conceit, excessive pride around self, but we are also not becoming wimps. The wonderful, I think it's wonderful, but the term that someone who, to say it this way, a little bit paradoxically, to fully be enlightened through the insight of not-self allows a person to roar like a lion. The lion's roar. Those two go together? Realizing not-self and having that kind of confidence of a lion? You know, how does that work? This kind of strength and confidence, you know, here I am. And so with these three conditions strongly in place, then when the time is ripe, when the conditions are in place, then there's a revelation. And the revelation at some point is a much deeper appreciation for how things are constantly changing, the impermanence of things. There's a deeper appreciation for the level, the degree, the way in which, the particular way in which suffering or dukkha or unsatisfactoriness permeates our world. And there's a deeper appreciation or insight into how impersonal everything is. But in English, to say things are impersonal can be kind of depressing also. But it's not depressing. It's actually all these experiences then, rather than being depressing, putting salt in the wound that some people have, they become liberating. And they become liberating because when we see the changing flux of things, then there's a feeling that they're unreliable to hold on to. It doesn't make any sense to hold on to them. There's an alternative to holding on. Now I see, only when we see how much things change all the time, do we have a clear insight, understanding of how we're actually clinging to things. Clinging to some idea that things are permanent or are lasting or that we can cling to them. And so then we begin to loosen, soften the grip. With enough well-being, seeing how unsatisfactory, the kind of way in which things are unsatisfactory, also begin to loosen our grip of trying to hold on to happiness, or hold on to things that are going to make us safe or make us happy. And then there's a feeling, oh, it feels good to let go. It's actually better. I'm actually happier. I'm actually happier now that I realize everything is suffering. It's kind of another one of these paradoxes, right? There's a wonderful, there was a monk who was in Thailand who lived in a cave for many, many years. And then after he died, they went to his cave and he'd done graffiti on the wall, painted paintings and things. And there was the drawing of a monk jumping up and he was kicking his heels together and hands were up and he was like clearly big smile and happy. And the caption over it said, "Oh, what boundless joy to know there's no true happiness." So, you know, it's kind of this paradox or this kind of way. As we have real insight into dukkha, there's a kind of willing to let go of something that paradoxically gives something back that's a whole different nature, a whole different kind of game in town of happiness, mahasukha, the great happiness. And then to start having insight how the impersonal nature of phenomena, how they belong without any need of labeling it, holding on to it as a self, or identifying it as this is me, myself, and mine. And to see it's not, you know, it doesn't really work to label it the self, to identify, to claim it as mine, to begin kind of to soften that intense grip we can have about me, myself, and mine, my experience, my thing, my this. And then the same thing, oh, it feels so good to put that down. Me, myself, and mine is called a burden. To put down the bag that you're carrying. Ah, what a relief. So this be willing, so that we cultivate the conditions that are the opposite of the three characteristics. So the opposite of impermanence is stability. The opposite of dukkha is well-being. The opposite of not-self is something like confidence and inner strength. And with those conditions in place, it becomes easier and easier to have the insights. And with the insights in place as a condition, when the time is ripe, when the egg is ready, the chicken is ready, chick is ready, it'll break free. And freedom sometimes is described as breaking free of the shell that holds us. And then we don't have to have a shell, which is pretty good. And if you're lucky, you can flap your wings and fly. I don't know how well chickens fly, but maybe I should use another bird next time for an analogy. So to take refuge in the Dharma, take refuge in the teachings, take refuge in the practices that cultivate conditions, and take refuge in how those conditions, when the time is ripe, mature into insight and realization. And to feel the support of that. And this, I think you really can feel that with conditionality. That as we practice, there are conditions that come into place that we feel supported by. They're not always there, but start having a feeling and a sense of the support that this provides. Gives a real clear sense of how the Dharma can be a refuge. And so even when it's not available, just simply knowing that it's there waiting for you, knowing that it's really built into the whole fabric of reality, fabric of your heart at least, that that the Dharma is always there to support you. And you can trust that support. So let's take a few minutes to collect ourselves, settle ourselves, so we have better condition for continuing this day's practice.